and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
And I'm back after...
You were sick.
After being gone last week, yeah. Had COVID for the... I don't know how many... I don't know what number that was anymore.
Fourth, fifth?
Fourth, probably, yeah. Usually, almost always, or at least three of them. Three times that I've been infected. It's been after the carnival season here in Germany, which makes sense. You're in these large, humid tents full of recirculated air and people moving around in, you know, close proximity.
Breathing on each other.
Yeah, so that's kind of my fault. It was. It is behavioral.
You're becoming a carnivalist, would be the term for people who love carnival and practice carnival and go to carnival parties and love the music. And...
If I can, yeah, try to provide a good argument for it, I think psychologically that desert of fun between Christmas and Easter, at least where those celebrations are celebrated, there's like this gap that's too long. In January and February, they can be really tough, kind of gray, kind of bleak, depending on what your weather is, what your climate is.
And carnival is your oasis then to continue with
it's a bright
metaphor?
Yeah, it's a bright candle or a lamp in the middle of that darkness. And once you get on the back end of it, Easter is right around the corner.
And then you got COVID and spent, what, a week at home?
Yeah, playing video games. I downloaded a new Blockbuster video game and got as far as I could get with my very limited video gaming skills. I'm just not, I ended up giving up because I'm just not very good. I don't have enough time.
What kind of effect did it have on your well-being? Playing a lot of video games, spending some hours playing video games?
It was fun. It's fun it will always feel like a guilty pleasure. I don't know why. It feels that way. It feels like I kind of could be doing something else more productive. I hate even saying that because I know that's not true. But that is what I feel, especially after 2 or 3 hours straight of it. Yeah. I get done and I'm like, what was that? What did I just even do? Yeah. I opened up a new area of the map and I beat a couple of characters with this new, you know, magic curse that I didn't know before. But who cares? Like, that's how I feel. Yeah.
The only reason I asked is there was a little bit of research done at Oxford University on this very topic. And they found that... They were looking at 703 gamers, and what they found was that the number of hours that these people played had no effect on their well-being.
Oh,
it wasn't
so they could
the
go
number
higher,
of hours. It
they could go higher and higher.
It doesn't matter how much you played, but what did matter with regard to your mood and well-being, and this is having a positive effect on you as a person, was how connected you felt to the game and the extent to which you felt that it fit into your life.
There you go. That part. For some reason, I don't know why, but it doesn't feel like video games fundamentally fit into my life. And it may be because I have, like a lot of parents out there, like you, working full-time and having children as well, you don't have much free time. So when you go all in on a video game, you're kind of...
You're wasting it. You have the feeling that you're wasting it.
Yeah.
I could be doing so many other things. I get such little time to actually do things, and I'm spending it playing this.
Right. Whereas if you had lots of free time, and that was part of your free time, part of my free time, I think I would feel differently about
it. And if you feel connected to the game and it fits in your life, that has a positive impact on your well-being, regardless of how much time you spend playing it. That's what the research out of Oxford says. So for people out there who like playing games, like gaming, and it fits into your life, go at it. Go hog wild. It is good for you.
It has a positive impact on their... Mental
well-being.
On their mental health, right? Yeah, it has to be mental because I would have to say that in terms of your physical health, I can't imagine that video gaming is good for that.
That's a good caveat, yeah.
Yeah, unless you're, I don't know, walking on a treadmill while playing the video game. Anyway, yeah, well, that I guess what that suggests is I need to change my psychology in order to be able to enjoy the experience more and choose some easier games.
Get connected with your game. Find a better game.
Too many buttons on these controllers these days. Okay, we're going to move from that that bit of science to what I'm just going to go out and say what I think is true, that this is the most important science story of the week.
And whoa.
That's why I'm going to talk about it. This was, or it begins at the very least, with a man from France stepping into an airplane and arriving at Houston in the U.S. state of Texas. On March 9th, we just found out about this yesterday. That's when the story hit the press, but tried to fly to Houston on March 9th. He works for France's National Center for Scientific Research. That's a publicly funded institution. It appears this is speculation, but the dates line up. He was trying to go to the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, which was just north of Houston from March 10 to 14th. And he got to the airport and was randomly selected to have his devices searched at the airport. They were searched. And then the airport authorities said, you are not allowed to enter the United States. Your right to visit the United States has been denied. And he was told to fly back to Europe.
On what grounds? Sorry to interrupt.
On the grounds that, and I'm going to quote the French Minister of Higher Education, this is and research, this is Philippe Baptiste. He said the measure was apparently taken by the American authorities because the researcher's phone contained exchanges with colleagues and friends in which he expressed a personal opinion on the Trump administration's research policy. This minister was quoted by the AFP, a French news agency, and was published in Le Monde. This is a French newspaper that has an English language edition. Yep. That's where I'm accessing this information. A diplomatic source later told the AFP, this French agency, that authorities found messages that, quote, express hatred towards Trump and can be qualified as terrorism. Now, those two things are very different.
Okay.
Hatred towards somebody and terrorism.
So this is this story because he was a researcher or because he said, I hate Trump on his phone at some point in time, if that is the case?
The latter.
Okay.
So it was...
This means because he wrote on his phone, I hate Donald Trump or something to that effect, the American authorities found that, therefore you can't enter the country.
Correct. That appears to be the case. The reason we're talking about this on this show is because he happened to be a scientist who was going to a conference, a science mm-hmm. conference, planetary research, and who works for the institute, for a publicly funded institute in France. But this could have been anyone, theoretically. But here, the reason I bring it up on this show is this is an example. I think a lot of people have followed various news stories out of the United States on measures being taken by the current U.S. administration that have a negative impact on science, whether on this could be anything from climate research to U.S. projects, aid projects around the world that have global health policy implications.
I've heard the word brain drain thrown around. There's going to be a brain drain. The academics in the U.S., the researchers in the U.S. are going to search for jobs elsewhere. One of our colleagues here in the science department at Deutsche Welle has reached out to the big four scientific institutions in Germany, Max Planck, Helmholtz, Leibniz, and Fraunhofer, to corroborate that, to see whether American researchers are reaching out to or filing applications for jobs at German institutions. Will find that out.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to say is it's connected to that, but there are two things happening in two different directions. One is the cutting of federal budgets and grants for people who are in the U.S., who are doing scientific research, and then the money dries up and you're out of a job or you're directly fired and you're going to be looking for jobs elsewhere, mm-hmm. right? But that's like an internal domestic fact. I think what's being ignored I'm claiming that this is the biggest science story this week is now you see it from a different direction. Here you have a chilling effect on people who would normally try to go in and to do good work that happens to be taking...
Collaboration.
Collaboration there. You can make the argument this event, this Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, also had a digital component. You could have just done it online, stay in your home country and be part of it. But it's anyone who's been to a conference knows a lot more happens when you meet people face-to-face. There's a reason this stuff works this way. I will also add here kind of two more points. One is that I highly recommend... For all of you out there, there's the Max Planck Institute here in Germany has published an interview with their director of the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology. And the title of the piece is I'm at a total loss for words at how hostility towards science has escalated in the U.S. Again, this is connected to
this is the head of the Institute for Meteorology here in Germany.
Yes, at the Max Planck Institute,
and he's speaking with regard to hostility in the U.S. How does he know
science? It's worth reading. A lot of it is connected to climate research and all of the knock-on effects that's going to have on his own work. But here is the part that stuck out with me. He said he mentioned to a colleague that there's going to be a symposium here in Germany to mark the Institute's 50th anniversary. I think he means the Institute of Meteorology.
Yeah.
His response was, well, he wasn't sure if he'd still have a job by then. He sounded deeply frustrated and demoralized. And then he goes on to say, the same colleague has now asked me to use his personal email address for communication because his government email is no longer secure. The implication was clear, quote, who knows who's spying on me? I've only encountered such concerns before in exchanges with Russian colleagues. But now, even in the United States, we have to ask ourselves, is it safe to send this to a government email address? I'm going to take a step back from what he is saying. This is, by the way, Joachim Marotska is his name. And just add, because I think sometimes it is of interest to the people out there listening, that this has a personal element as well for you and for me. We're talking about it at lunch. I have to ask myself, for example, when we plan to travel to the United States next, the plan is to travel there this summer, whether my own wife may have sent something, communicated something on her phone somewhere, and that if she's chosen at random as we try to travel to the United States, that that could cause a problem. Again, very unlikely. And then I also have to ask myself, does saying this into a microphone on the air increase those chances? It's just very, very, very concerning. Yeah. It's something that European scientists, European researchers are paying attention to. I saw a comment from the UK saying that one of the scientists there who would have typically traveled with his team to the United States for conferences is not going to do that because of the national backgrounds of some of his team members. He can't be certain anymore that that flight is going to work well. So a very small news story or event from Houston, Texas, that has a lot of ripples coming back toward Europe and changing the way people think about going to the U.S. to do research there.
Ripples that hopefully won't become bigger waves at a later point in time.
I think it's
where this is going. It's foreboding.
Right.
Absolutely ominous, no question about it. But what it's going to lead to, we don't.
No, but I think being aware, that's why some of you will have seen this news story. Many of you won't. And I don't think it should just be, you know, passed over as one of those news stories. This is a pretty shocking one that I think it's good to be informed about and to have an opinion on. And I will end by saying, again, we don't know what was on the phone or the laptop. If there's a clear threat of violence toward anyone, politician or otherwise, in the country you're traveling to, of course, a border authority could say, look, it looks like...
Right, of course. But if it's just an opinion on what this researcher feels about a head of state, then come on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing before we go worth knowing is that if you have ever been in a relationship that ended... A romantic relationship, if you have ever broken up with anyone.
Oh, yeah.
It will, according to this study, take 8 years for that bond of attachment to disappear.
8 years?
Yeah. They were looking at 328 people. This is the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. For these 320, on average, it took 8.5 years for the bond to disappear. 4.18 years. I love how it makes me feel like these people are isotopes. They were looking at the amount of time it took for the bond to dissipate by half or vanish by half. I mean, we're not radioactive elements with half lives.
Maybe we are.
But 4.18 years for the bond of attachment to be halved.
I would have to ask, as someone who... do you remember those days back in like grade school when people would be quote unquote together, boyfriend, girlfriend, or boyfriend, girlfriend?
Emily Piette, Edie Cachot, absolutely. Yeah.
For like a day or 2 days or 3 days, right? And so
mine with Emily lasted a couple of weeks, yeah.
So this would have to be, the 8 years would have to be based, this would have to be a committed, serious relationship with deep romantic.
On average, again, 328 people, the average amount of time that the relationship lasted was 5 years. So we're talking pretty serious.
Serious, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would line up with my college. Yeah. Relationship, my biggest college relationship.
Well, according to this research, it took 8 years for you to get over that.
Her,
yeah.
8 years? Yeah, that's about right.
Okay, one takeaway here from it, the way to get over a relationship or the factors that lead to how long it takes for you to get over, it has nothing to do with having a relationship afterwards or your gender or whether you had kids with the ex. The most important thing by far is, do you have contact with that ex still?
Oh, meaning
are you still in contact with that ex somehow?
It's better to be in contact? No, it's better to cut it off.
Cut it off. Absolutely cut it off. It's going to hurt at first, but it will lead to that bond of attachment going down to zero.
That is exactly how
that person becomes a stranger.
That is exactly how it happened
eventually.
With me. That's funny. Very, very last thing here, because we usually start this show with emails from all of you, and we've gotten tons, and we just jumped right into the science this time.
We forgot the emails.
Yeah, I'm going to end with one. Or by paraphrasing it, one of our longtime listeners, you know who you are, emailing us about the discovery of a further 128 Saturnian moons. So the Saturn, you know, that big planet with the ring around it.
How many moons are in our solar system?
More than 400. Okay. You can go to Wikipedia and look at
and
all
400. And now we have 128 more?
I believe the Wikipedia has been updated to reflect the new 128.
Oh.
This was research from Taiwan, Canada, USA, and France, and they were using the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope to look out there. And what they saw were, quote-unquote, irregular moons, roughly a few kilometers in size. My question then was like, wait, I'd never thought about that, but what's the smallest a moon can be? Right? Because Saturn has all these ice blocks. That's what the ring is. Ice blocks, rocks, dust. Right? What qualifies a moon? When is it not a moon?
Yeah.
No answer. The International Astronomical Union does not have a definition.
Huh.
It's kind of seems like if you can see it with a telescope, and it's kind of like these a few kilometers in size, that apparently is a moon.
Wait, what is a moon? If I'm revolving around you all day long, am I a moon? Am I one of your moons?
Yes. Or if you're small enough, you'd be a moonlit.
Moonlit.
That's another word that I was relatively new to me. Anyway, why did one of our listeners send this to me? Well, there was a link to one of the astronomers, and her name is Sam Lawler, and she was talking about how she accidentally discovered this. She was trying to aim the telescope at the Kuiper Belt. This is like an asteroid belt, but out beyond, kind of Pluto and beyond. And then accidentally, Saturn crossed the path. She hadn't really been planning that. And she, as astronomer Sam Lawler, is from Regina.
No!
Regina, Canada. Anyone who has been listening to the show for the last couple of weeks knows exactly why that's relevant to us and to this show. And so thank you. Thank you for linking us back to that Canadian city.
Enough said. Anybody, what do you guys have to say about anything we've said today? SU@dw.com. Please get in touch. Décor fade, il se balade, d'humeur exécrable, arbore un vulgaire, sourire de façade, les pieds traînent, souillés, mouillés, son humeur se dégrade, à la vue de l'état des rues, des trottoirs crades, il voit des zombies sombrés, inévitables noyades, vent pollué, broyé, l'époque est malade, dans ses oreilles coule le gaz, des bulles de black sad, écriture limonade, poésie, un bras maussade, bande originale d'un jour malheureux. Relationships, that was one of the topics that we had. I was talking about how long it takes to get over a breakup.
8 years.
Or get over your ex. What if your relationship that you got going right now is kind of on the rocks? You're feeling lonely in that relationship. Is there anything you can do about it? And what does gratitude and forgiveness play in that? We're going to hear from Shalom Levitt now from Brigham Young University.
Science Unscripted.
I'm Shalom Levitt. I am an associate professor at Brigham Young University. And I just studied recently couples who were lonely and looked at how that impacted their relationship and their sexual relationship.
And Shalom, what was the primary conclusion of that study?
Well, first of all, that loneliness is really powerful, and we all feel it in our relationships at times. The main finding was that if you can be more forgiving and feel more gratitude, we see a big buffer for the romantic relationship, not so much for the sexual relationship.
Real quickly, can you just define what loneliness in a relationship means? Because I think for some people out there, not everyone, but some people might be thinking, well, that's kind of contradictory. You're in a relationship. How are you lonely in a relationship?
Oh, it is so easy to be lonely in a relationship. And I think that most people would agree. When we actually ask this question, I would say the majority of our participants will say, yeah, there are moments where I have been lonely in my relationship. And that's understandable because we know our partner can only really fulfill about 60% of our needs for connection. So we have to have other connections. But at times in anybody's life, we're going to have moments where we're feeling lonely, where we can actually have both partners reporting loneliness. And so loneliness in a relationship is really just where I'm feeling a little unseen. I'm not feeling the connection that I would like to feel. And so it's pretty subjective, right? I'm the one deciding whether or not I'm lonely. It's not that I'm always by myself. I can be lonely in someone else's presence. And so, yeah, we know from relationship research that people absolutely feel lonely in relationships.
And what does loneliness feel like inside of, if you're in a relationship? What is a telltale sign based on this feeling that I've got right now? I'm lonely right now, and I need to do something about it. What is it?
Yeah, maybe you're in your head a little bit more. You're feeling isolated. Maybe that you can't talk to your partner about, you know, whatever negative feelings you're experiencing. You're feeling distance, right? So I would say how most people who are single or who aren't in relationships, we feel that way outside of a relationship. The truth is we can feel that inside a relationship as well. It's a bit of a problem that we have all come to believe that we shouldn't feel lonely if we're in a relationship. That's actually something we need to be able to admit and then talk about.
This experiment, or this study rather, was not an intervention. You didn't force people to try to become more grateful or to forgive more. But I do believe personally that that is possible, because I know, you know, if you're writing like a Valentine's letter or anything where you're forced to actually list why you love someone, the reasons you do, it like recharges that. I do think it has that effect. So my question is really, for our listeners out there, can they generate it out of nothing? Like, is there an exercise they can do to forgive and be grateful for their partners more?
Yes, absolutely. And there's a researcher named Frank Fincham who has actually done experiments like that. And yes, it absolutely does change. And I'm going off of memory here, but it seems to me it had a lasting effect, you know, at least for a few weeks, that if I would practice being more forgiving, that's what he was studying, does it change my relationship quality? And yes, it did.
Gratitude and forgiveness don't help the sexual relationship.
That's right.
Why not? Why would those two things, those two phenomena, help a romantic relationship but not the sex?
I think it's because these are two virtues or qualities that are wonderful, and we know pretty powerful, right? It helps the relationship. But sex is something that is pretty complex and even more intimate than just your general romantic relationship. So if there are struggles in sex, we know there has to be a pretty potent solution to really impact. And what we saw was that gratitude and forgiveness just aren't quite potent enough. They certainly help the relationship, but not the sex.
So if forgiveness and gratitude don't improve sex, I'll ask a question that I think everyone is wondering, Shalom, what does improve it?
I am also a mindfulness researcher, and so that was the next thing we looked at. Does mindfulness, and specifically, does mindfulness during sex, which we call sexual mindfulness, does that help the sexual relationship? And the answer is yes, it does. And so what that really means is when I'm lonely and I'm feeling pretty isolated or unseen, can I pay attention to how it feels when my partner touches me during sex or the emotions that I'm experiencing? Can I kind of settle into my body and be a little more aware of what's happening in the moment? And what we found is even for people who are lonely, that seems to help their sexual relationship. It's just a way of being even more present in this very intimate experience with your partner.
And your partner has to be on board with that? They have to know this is happening and they're maybe doing the same thing? Or can it be one-sided?
It can be one-sided, and that's the beauty of it. We don't have to have partner buy-in for this, but we know that it does help when our partner is also trying to be mindful during sex. It's, again, there are actor effects, so it impacts me, but there are also partner effects, which means my behavior impacts my partner.
I'm just going to have to ask you one last time here for people listening to this who don't know how or don't know what sexual mindfulness is. What should they be doing if they're having a tough time in the bedroom or they're having problems with this? How can you practice this in the best way possible?
I actually teach a whole intervention on how to be more sexually mindful. But the basic idea is that if I can start practicing being mindful at work, as I'm walking along the sidewalk, as I'm eating, then I can start applying that same sense of being present in the moment to my sexual relationship. So I can slow down my thoughts. I'm not thinking about, what I need to get done, later in the day, or I'm not thinking about the goal of orgasming. Right? I'm just staying right here in the moment. How does it feel when we kiss? How does it feel to just be this close to one another? How am I feeling emotionally? Right? If I can slow down and just pay attention to this moment, right? Just this touch, then I can free up in my mind room for greater connection. It's really a process that you have to learn. So it's not going to happen like magic on the first time you try, but you will get better at it. And so people who can be more present in sex will feel greater connection, and the loneliness will have a little bit less of a negative impact.
That was Shalom Levitt speaking to us from Utah.
Yeah. Lots of, I think, practical tips for people out there. And I'll just leave that there for now and go on to saying what I think was the most interesting thing that happened after our interview with Shalom. We were talking to her about publishing this.
Yeah.
And she suggested, I could also publish it on Instagram, where I have an account. And something Scotland. It's like, okay. And I asked her, I was like, well, do you have a Scottish team of researchers? I didn't see that in the study. Were they also involved in the study? No, it's not a research team. It's that we have a castle.
Yeah. She shared some personal information about how it's been her dream to buy and restore a castle. And that's exactly what they've done. And now you guys can check it out if you want. What is the name of?
It's Knockderry, one word. Knock like you're knocking on a door. Derry, Knockderry Castle. It's in Scotland. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's right on the water.
Take the tour.
And if you're anything like us, yeah, you will immediately after that this really fascinating interview spend the next 30 minutes looking at pictures of a castle and imagining what it's like to try to restore a castle like that. That was an unexpected twist on the back end of this wonderful conversation with researcher Shalom Levitt.
No, we'd be happy to hear your thoughts about the castle, but also if you have tried well-being in your sex life. I'm genuinely interested in what effect that has.
This is what you want. What do you want them to say, Gabriel?
I'm just interested.
We all are. And then, yeah, if you do decide to send that, we'll have to decide what to talk about, what can be talked about on the air. In addition to that, have you tried forgiveness? Did that work for you? Have you tried gratitude? Did that work? Are you lonely? I think that's underestimated. How many people are in relationships and from the outside you'd think, wow, they're,
Yeah, use this parasocial relationship that you have with us to tell us about your loneliness.
Yeah. SU@dw.com.
Science Unscripted.
Lying here in the dark tonight, I'm holding on to your precious light as I wait for the morning to win this fight. I'm back home in your arms. Swallowing all those bitter pills. Trying to shake an apathy that kills. And I'm running free out of the dark green hills to be back.
DW, made for minds.